Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our broadcast today brought to you by Harry's Razors, a better shave experience delivered right to your door. And a great gift for yourself or somebody you care about. $5 off your first purchase if you use the coupon code THINKINGATHEIST. Go to harrys.com, harrys.com. Tonight's broadcast is about changing minds. Is it possible to talk somebody out of their faith? We're going to deal with a specific angle that's posited by Dr. Peter Boghossian in his book, A Manual for Creating Atheist. I had him on the show a couple years ago. The book's been out. People have been implementing these techniques, especially one guy named Anthony Magnabosco has a YouTube channel, and he's had such success with it out in the field that I asked Anthony to be a part of the conversation. He's going to join us in just a few minutes. So he goes out in public with a video camera and he engages religious believers, just random people. He documents those encounters on video, and in just a few minutes you can see a shift taking place in how they think about their religious belief, about their God belief, about how and why they came to quote-unquote know what they think they know. I found it fascinating. Tonight's broadcast for some people is going to be an epiphany. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be another tool in the arsenal. For other people, it's going to be maddening and frustrating because they're going to think all of this is a bunch of crap. So I'll let the comment section have a field day with what we're talking about at the end of the broadcast tonight. But I would encourage you to take the journey with me because I find this approach compelling and much different than the point-counterpoint tactics that we're all so used to doing. Somebody says the Bible is perfect. Well, our first response is to go to the pages of Scripture and say, well, here's some imperfection. Somebody says evolution is not true, and you go and find specific proofs of the fact of evolution and demonstrate those. Someone says this is a supernatural miracle, and you provide evidence that no, this actually has a natural explanation. And I think these approaches still have merit. I think we still need to be about the facts, and we need to be about data. But what happens when we go beyond the data and we get into why and how someone came to embrace the data, quote unquote, what they know in the first place? That's the angle we're going to take tonight. And I think you're going to find it very, very interesting. First, I do want to thank our show sponsor. We're getting into the season for holiday gifts. Harry's Razors is providing some great gift options. Their starter set is called the Truman Set. It runs just $15. With the $5 off coupon code on your first purchase, that's down to $10. That's a great gift. The limited edition Ex-Movember Set runs you $20. The premium Winston Set is only $25. Quality design, precision razor blades crafted from their factory in Germany. Your choice of shave cream or foaming gel. It's a nice presentation as well, which makes Harry's Razors an even easier choice as gifts for somebody you love. And free shipping, which is really nice for somebody who thought they got a great deal online and then they ended up paying a ton of money to have it shipped to them. I like their style. I like their razors. I like their business model, which cuts out the middleman and the middleman expenses. And I'm glad for their support on this radio show and, of course, for your support as well. Harry's Razors. Check them out online. And remember that coupon code THINKINGATHEIST for $5 off your first purchase. Harry's.com. HARRYS.com. Dr. Peter Boghossian is a philosopher, author, and activist. His writings have been seen in a host of publications, far too many to mention here, but they do include the Journal of Philosophy and Education, Skeptical Inquirer, and many others. He wrote the National Philosophy Curricula for the University of Phoenix. He teaches on a number of subjects related to philosophy, skepticism, and critical thinking at Portland State University. And of course, he's author of the 2013 book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. Anthony Magnabosco is a YouTube activist and a street epistemologist who's been implementing these techniques and engaging total strangers on the street, posting video of those encounters online. He's had such success with it, I've asked him to join the conversation here in just a few minutes. But first, let's start with Dr. Peter Boghossian. Peter, thanks so much for joining me on the radio. Great to have you.
Thanks, Seth. Appreciate it.
We talked a while back. We were talking about your book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. Do you ever take any heat for saying it that way? I want to create atheists. And some of the criticisms have been, well, actually, we want to create rationalists, and then atheism is supposedly going to be the result. Does that ever happen?
Yeah, a lot of people were dissatisfied with the title. Part of the reason for the title was it was an opportunity to have a conversation about what that means to be an atheist and how does one go about doing that. And actually, in that sense, the title was very successful.
Well, give me the Cliff's Notes version of the book. I want people to actually go to the book. I will link it in the description box. But what's your angle?
It draws from multiple schools of thought and teaches people how to talk to other people about their faith-based beliefs in a way that's non-threatening, non-confrontational. It's not a debate. It's not hostile, to help them be more honest with themselves, reflect upon those beliefs. And if there isn't sufficient reason or evidence to have those beliefs, then discard them. It's primarily rooted in the Socratic method, although it heavily draws from contemporary tools and psychology and drug counseling and cult exiting. But overall, it lays a foundation. It has a template for how to talk to religious believers and talk them out of faith and superstition.
You have some experience with using this method in other capacities or what?
Yeah, I've done it for years as a philosophy professor. I've done it in the prisons. I've done it in hospitals, Fortune 100 companies. I've done it all around the world. And it's an incredibly effective, and it's not anything that's particularly unique, although drawing in from other schools and using it in specific ways is unique. Socrates laid these foundations down, or Plato laid them down, from Socrates' dialogues 2,400 years ago.
As you're a philosopher, I have been thinking at one point we may have to do a show on the merits of philosophy. This is a classic debate. Is philosophy useful in determining truth or what have you?
Great question. Sorry to interrupt you. I just finished a chapter for Russell Blackford's book about Has Philosophy Made Progress? I wrote that with James Lindsay. And Daniel Dennett has an article about chemess, C-H-M-E-S-S. It's a made-up game. And in this book chapter for Russell Blackford, Lindsay holds a PhD in mathematics and is the author of three books. His recent one is Everybody is Wrong About God. In this article, we talk about how chemess, which is one variation where the king moves twice, it's a game, but it's a game nobody plays. And I think that's what's happening in philosophy now. Philosophical projects are becoming baroque, inconsequential, nobody really cares about them, and nobody outside of a sub-sub-specialty can understand what anybody else is talking about. So I think philosophy has lost its way and needs to retether itself back to science so it can gain respectability.
I've seen many debates and discussions, the scientist versus the philosopher kind of a thing. And everybody seems to be taking a pretty hard line, defending their territory, you know.
Yeah, and that's a really insightful thing to say. That's right. And it shouldn't be about defending territory. It shouldn't be about how many hours you've put into a discipline or what your PhD is in. It should be about what's the best method for finding truth. And has philosophy strayed? Has it confused the map for the terrain? And how do we, if it has, then how do we retether it to a truth-seeking enterprise?
Well, we'll let the comments section chew on that when we may tackle philosophy again down the way. It's sort of on my list of a few things that we may cover, but, you know, I'm just trying to decide how much you know, how much of a shitstorm do we really want to,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah, you can only harbor so many enemies at one time. You can go after faith, the faith virus. You can go after what Majid Nawaz and Sam Harris and others have been talking about, regressive leftism. You can go after the excesses in campus censorship, et cetera, which is kind of an outgrowth or a manifestation of regressive leftism. There comes a time when you just reach a critical point for people who despise you and your ideas. And I think that was actually evident in Sam Harris's last podcast. There comes a price for speaking well, for well-considered or well-reasoned opinion. When you speak out in this environment that we've created for ourselves in the age of social media with Twitter, et cetera, and often that translates into personal attacks on people who have agreements which are discordant to the norm.
For me, it becomes more of a question of focus, too. My battle is not over here. The fire in my belly is not about philosophy. You know, I'm fighting other things. I want to speak about other things. I want to play to my areas of strength and learn more in my areas of weakness. But there comes a point when you try to cast too wide a net, you just right. dilute yourself to a point of near ineffectiveness. It's distraction.
Yeah, that's why if you really think about what you just said and let it percolate, one of the things that you have to have as a condition to allow you to do that in the first place is an environment where we have open inquiry. And that is absolutely not what we have on campus today. And so that's a battle in which I've recently placed myself along with others like Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff from FIRE. And boy, the list goes on and on. Michael Shermer, Steven Pinker. The problem is that we are increasingly not able to have these conversations about controversial topics or about topics which may quote-unquote trigger students. And more we see anytime people are asked to substantively reflect on their beliefs, that's considered to be a what's termed a microaggression, an aggressive act. So we can't even get to talking about philosophy or science or what have you if we've created a culture or an environment in which people are so offended by everything that even bringing up these things and asking people to seriously reflect on the substance of their beliefs is itself considered some kind of an aggressive or hostile action.
It is frustrating, though, when you bring a well-defended, I mean, you don't have the answer with a capital A, but you bring a well-defended position and you ask someone else to defend their position or to at least explain it in some way. And they just give you that look, you know, that look of pity and condescension. And, you know, atheists aren't immune to this either. You know, we can be irrational about a great many things.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation. You know, if you look at the Wendy Wright and Richard Dawkins conversation, somebody who's put in an unbelievable number of hours of scholarship and careful consideration of something, just to have those arguments wholesale discarded is incredibly frustrating. And that's why I think that it's really important that we break down these barriers of certainty. And we need cultural shifts to make saying, I don't know, a virtue. And we are so far from that now. We're so far from having an environment not only in which we can ask questions, but where I don't know is met with a scoff or it's met with a sneer or people think you're stupid. So in many ways, street epistemology and what you see Anthony do in those videos, that's a call for people to be more humble about what it is that they claim to know and more reflective about their beliefs. And you're right, it's not just their God beliefs. And when you see Anthony's videos, he talks to people who believe in karma. He talks to atheists. It's never a bad thing to be more thoughtful and reflective about what it is that you believe. And when someone asks you questions about that, to answer those questions sincerely, to not try to game it or to not try to win, but to really engage with somebody in a constructive way so that you're a partner in conversation so that you too can find out what's true. And again, unfortunately, the environments that we've created are so toxic right now that those conversations are increasingly difficult.
You and I had a conversation in Vancouver, and there's a short form video of that conversation on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel called Dr. Peter Boghossian Changing Minds, where you talked about an encounter where you had a theist, someone, did they interrupt you during a speech? Were they protesting? And everybody wanted you to shout them down, call them out, humiliate them, and instead you engaged and afterwards experienced a measure of backlash for doing so. You want to flesh that out for me?
Yeah, it was a talk I gave at Portland State University. And I read a paper. I don't usually do that. But I read a paper for John Loftus's book about Christianity, not his recent one, but the one before this. And there are many people in the audience many Christians who tried to monopolize the conversation or who tried to hijack the discourse. And I let them speak, perhaps admittedly, maybe more than I should, but not really. And I really attempted to model the behavior that I wanted other people to do, specifically the people who were arguing, and they didn't, arguing is not really the right word. Arguing is a term in philosophy. It basically means when you give a reason, when you try to defend your position, but it has a meaning in a broader context. You know, when two people get in a fight with each other, it's like an angry dispute that's heated. These people fell into the latter camp. And so when I listened to them and I gave them time, and no matter where I go, no matter where I speak, I just got back from a 2-month tour in Australia and New Zealand. I always, always give people who disagree with my ideas more time, and I let them speak first. And often, atheists in particular, they become upset, or they say, you know, why didn't you, you know, give it to them, or why don't you just ridicule them, or they don't use the word ridicule, just, you know, shut them up. But I mean, cui bono, the Latin expression, like, who benefits from that? What advantage does that, all that does is that brings us further along in a culture in which we're not able to have these conversations, and we don't look at people as genuine partners in truth seeking. Now, you have to draw certain lines in the sand. I mean, there are certain times when you can't let somebody walk over you, but you really also have to listen very intently to what they're saying.
Is part of that difference someone's talking to you instead of at you, right? If they're talking at you, if someone's there just to flex their apologetics muscle, if they're self-gratifying. I mean, anyone who thought an omnipotent God would genuinely need them to go and do battle against Dr. Peter Boghossian is betraying the fact that they don't think their God can handle himself. So they're really there to say, hey, look at me. I am a soldier in God's army. And if he's talking at you and a chance to draw a spotlight unto himself, that becomes a real challenge. How do you draw that line?
That is a great question. And I think that's exactly what's happening. And as long as I've been doing this, as many people as I've taught, it is still something where I'm trying to find, you know, how to do that in a way that's gentle enough to help the person with whom you're speaking, while at the same time maintaining a boundary and having a respectful conversation.
Let's bring on Anthony Magnabosco. He is a street epistemologist. We're going to get into sort of definitions here. But he's a YouTube activist who has posted some really intriguing videos using a method I'm guessing that he has sort of derived from your book. Anthony, do I have you on the radio?
I am here.
Is that the origin of this particular method, or were you doing this before?
The method originated from Peter's book. I've had the pleasure of being able to take the concepts from his book and actually employ them right out into the field. The manner in which I've done that when I first started, of course, was not very good, I have to admit. But after a lot of practice and a lot of mistakes and learning, I feel that I've gotten a little bit better at it.
Dr. Boghossian, can you define epistemology versus street epistemology? And I want Anthony to kind of weigh in afterwards. How do you define this for people? What's the difference?
So epistemology is basically the study of knowledge. It tends to be a very, very academic exercise. Street epistemology is the same thing as the study of knowledge, or how we know what we know, but in a way that's real, in a way that doesn't use big words, in a way that, to draw from a phrase from motivational interviewing, which is in the psychology literature, you meet people where they are. And so it's not about pretension. It's not about verbiage or academic language. It's just being real with people about how they know what they think they know.
Anything to add, Anthony?
Yeah, I guess I could just add that it really is just friendly conversation aimed at uncovering the reasons for deeply held beliefs. It's a friendly activity. It shouldn't be approached as an obligation, or if somebody is, you know, doesn't want to participate in it. It needs to be a mutually agreed upon activity, I guess you could say, where it's just friendly. It should be friendly and it should be open. And both sides, actually, I think, should be open to reexamining why they believe what they believe.
I'm going to play a few clips from your YouTube channel with your permission. Obviously, it's audio only, but it's enough. We're hearing the conversation. We're hearing tactics. We're hearing How do you go about getting someone to perhaps reevaluate their deep-seated and cherished religious belief? Before I play that, I want to read a couple of quotes, actually more than a couple, that were posted on my social media pages about tactics and whether or not we can actually change minds. Christopher said, "The tactic that works is to compare and contrast. Nothing says bullshit like bringing up religions and beliefs that existed centuries before theirs when their messiah is identical to other messiahs. That's hard to fudge." Either of you have a comment on that one?
You know, with street epistemology, it's really not about focusing on the facts or the conclusions that theists have arrived at. It's more about the method and why. Why do they think it's true? So it's so easy to get focused on the facts that, well, you know, your book isn't as old as this other book. Well, you know, why do you possibly believe it? And it's so difficult, I think, to get past that phase where you're focused on the counter-apologetics. So many atheists know facts about the Bible and facts about the Quran and that type of thing. When you're conversing with somebody using street epistemology, it's not the direction that we want to go. It's more about how the person is so certain that what they believe is true. So it's about the method. It's about the manner with which they arrived at that belief.
Karen said this, "I have conversations like I play chess. I keep asking questions. Eventually, they'll make a mistake." Thoughts?
I don't know if that's a helpful way, because what if you're the one who's making a mistake? And so I think it's a sort of belief closure. I mean, in the Philebus, Socrates says it's better to be wrong than it is to show someone else's argument is wrong. Because if you're wrong, at least you can make that correction. And so I think the attitude or an attitudinal disposition of being open to revise what you believe is essential for street epistemology. Because I really am genuinely curious, and I think Anthony's spot on, how does someone know what they know? And if they have a method of knowing that you don't, you should use that method to know reality. I have yet to see anyone who has a method of knowing God that hasn't been debunked, but I'm open to consider it. I'm open to the possibility that someone knows something I don't know. And again, the idea is that you focus on the method of knowing and not the conclusion. And so many atheists make that very, very fundamental mistake.
And if I could build off of that, if you don't mind, when I approach a conversation, and it was different when I first started out, but these days when I'm doing street epistemology, it's not a competition. The chess example, you know, sort of implies that there's two sides. I like to approach this as a partnership. How could we work together to figure out if what you're believing in is true? And I think that's a fundamental difference with this approach than you might find with a typical debate.
I've got a few other pieces of input from listeners that I want to share in just a second. But first, I want to play this clip. It's fascinating. You are engaging someone named Miguel. Can you set it up for me real fast, Anthony?
Miguel is a young man on a college campus who has been observing me talking to people randomly at his school for a week or two. And I think the curiosity got the better of him. And he just walked up to me and said, you know, what are you doing out here? And we ended up having the most wonderful conversation to, number one, find out what he believes. And number two, why does he believe it? And it's a respectful back and forth. Nobody is raising their voice. Nobody's laughing at the other person. We ended on a handshake. And it was a fantastic talk where this gentleman, you know, initially put himself 100% confident that what he's believing in is true. And by the end of the 10-minute or so talk, he could no longer explain how he could possibly be that confident.
It's fascinating to watch this shift happen, and that's why I'm going to play the entire just over nine minute exchange between Anthony and a guy named Miguel. Now, how do you do this? You go out to a college campus with a camera and just say, hi, can we talk? Is that how you do it, or what?
I will go to any location and talk with anybody about pretty much anything.
Okay.
You don't have to go to a college campus. I like that because it's a public spot. The people there tend to be a little bit more open, and they're already in an environment where they're being challenged a little bit. So it's not too unusual for them to engage with somebody with these type of topics. But I've had similar conversations in a line at a bookstore or on an airplane. So you can really have these anywhere. There is a knee-jerk misunderstanding about street epistemology, and that it has to be out on the street. And that's really not the case. you can have these talks anywhere.
Here's the conversation between Miguel and Anthony Magnabosco.
Hey.
Hey, I just had a question. What are you doing?
I'm interviewing people.
Oh,
my first name's Anthony.
Miguel.
Miguel?
Yes,
oh,
sir.
Nice to meet you. Yeah, I'm just interviewing strangers about how they arrived at their God belief.
And
just
cool.
Do you want to do a quick interview?
Yeah, for
All right,
sure.
Awesome. I'll time it for 5.
Okay.
Miguel.
Well,
what God do you believe in, dude?
I believe in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior.
Why?
Because I know he died on the cross, and I know he's the Almighty God.
Okay. How confident are you that the belief is true? If 100% was, I'm 100% confident that Jesus died on the cross for me, and 0% is, I'm not confident at all that Jesus died for me, where would you be on the scale?
On the 100%.
Wow.
Yeah. Although sometimes I may feel like I struggle with my faith sometimes, you know how we, sometimes you go through things and we feel like God's not here, and in reality, you know, we share away from him. He never leaves us.
And okay.
So I always know, like,
you just know it.
Yeah.
How do you know it, dude? How can you be 100% confident on a belief?
I don't know, just, I guess, faith. And just the foundation I was raised upon.
Faith. What is your definition of faith? If I were to write it down on this clipboard right now, what would you,
faith is
how would you describe it?
The hope in things unseen.
The hope in things unseen?
Thanks, man.
See you later. All right.
Yeah. And that's faith.
I would say so. Would you give a different term?
I've heard similar definitions of it. When, how big of your belief, that 100% is faith, and how, what other percent is you being raised in it? Because I think you mentioned that you you're exposed to it.
In situations, like, God has just, like, showed up in my life, you know, and in my family's life. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. Like, I grew up without my dad, because
uh-huh.
he kind of cheated on my mom, had a baby.
Sorry to hear that.
You know, like, I just went through a lot of stuff when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I came to, like, I guess you could say, like, a real like truth to who Jesus was, you know. Like, I got saved when I was 5. Like when I got saved
at 5 years old.
Yeah, like my grandma talked to me, like she introduced me to Jesus, and like at that time, like when I was 5 years old, I knew I was gonna go to heaven. You know what I mean? Like, I would just.
Can we get back to the faith part of it?
Yeah.
I know that you're using faith to be so confident that Jesus works in your life and died for you, and you believe it so strongly. And you define it as the hope in things unseen. Do you have hope? Do you use faith for other things? And do you hope for things that are unseen in your life?
Yes.
Besides Jesus?
Yeah, I think
you do?
People put their faith in all types of stuff.
Like,
but
what?
I guess, like, just, like, for example, I have a test on Wednesday. And I hope I pass on Wednesday.
You hope you pass.
You know what I mean?
Are you equating faith with hope? Faith, hope. Is faith the same as hope?
I wouldn't say faith is the same as hope, but faith, you kind of put your hope in faith.
Hmm.
I don't know.
With regards to this example for use for this test, you hope that you pass it.
But I know in order for me to pass it, I have to study.
Sure.
To understand the material.
Okay.
Before I take the test.
Yeah.
You know?
When you hope that you pass the test, is there not an element of a possibility that you might fail the test?
Yes.
Is hope the same way? Does hope does faith have an element of it possibly not happening or not being true?
I guess that's just something that you just don't know until you die. If we talk about Jesus, you know what I mean? Because, like, I guess somebody could have, like, a possibility, like, maybe God isn't real. But then, like, and then if I'm wrong, then I guess I'd have to face that when I die. But then if I'm right, then somebody else has to face that when they die. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Miguel, if faith is equivalent to hope with your definition of it, and there's an element of it not happening or not coming true because hope has that possibility of it not you hope you want to pass the test and maybe you won't pass the test, right? If faith is hope and it has that element of it not being true, can somebody really be at the 100% mark on the confidence of a belief being true?
I would say so. Because it's like you put your all into that. Like, you know, like, I put my all into Jesus.
You're invested into it?
Yeah. And it's a daily, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like the Bible says work out daily. You know what I mean? And I, like, sometimes, like, some days, we don't really... I don't know if you're a believer or...
I'll answer it later.
I don't know how you believe or I don't even think like that. But, I mean, like, you know, like, I just feel like daily, you know what I mean? Like, you work out your faith on a daily basis, you know, because God's grace is renewed every day in our lives.
Are you saying that because you've invested so much into the belief that it's difficult to consider that the belief might not be true?
I guess. That was fast.
That was a fast five, wasn't it? Do you want to go another couple minutes?
Sure.
Okay. I find it really fascinating that this investment in the belief and your acknowledgement that because I've invested so much time and effort into the belief that I'm reluctant to even examine if the belief might not be true. Is that what you're saying? I don't want to put words in your mouth, so correct
me. That is what I'm saying.
It is?
Yeah, like, you know, like to me, like, in a way, I think, how can God not be real? You know what I mean? Like, out of everything that's in the world and everything that you see, like, the sky and, like, just, like, everything, like, how could it be something other than God? You know?
Just not knowing something makes you think it's all the more possible that this specific God exists in the life?
I would say so.
You know, I've had conversations with people of other religions on this campus and elsewhere.
For sure.
I've talked to a Muslim woman who said that she's 100% convinced that Allah is the one true God. And I think we probably agree she has the right to believe in that God. She uses faith and she hopes that Allah is real. She hopes it. And she's invested a lot of time in the belief. Right? Like, she was raised in it. She puts a lot of time in it. She goes to the mosque and does all these prayers. She's invested a lot of time in it. She hopes that it's real. She really wants it to be real because she's invested so much time in it.
Mm-hmm.
In what way does that make her belief any more true than yours?
I don't know too much about the Muslim religion, so I don't know how.
You don't even have to know about it. Like, I don't know much about it either, but she's convinced about it.
Yeah.
You know, she's certain. She's 100% convinced that the belief is true and that Muhammad went to heaven on a winged horse. Like, she really believes it.
Mm-hmm.
She uses faith. She hopes that it's true. She's invested a tremendous amount of time in the belief. How could she be so confident in the belief that's a completely different belief than you?
I don't know. I see what you're saying. Maybe just her upbringing?
Do you think her upbringing has any bearing on the truth of the belief?
No, because I know that Allah is not real. I know that there's only one true God.
So her being raised in the culture has no bearing on the belief being true,
yeah.
Her belief in Allah.
Yeah.
Yet you're standing here today, possibly largely because you were raised in it and exposed to this specific God?
But I think if I wasn't raised, like, just like stuff that I've been through in my life, you know what I mean? Like.
You think if you were raised in to be a Hindu, you might be a Christian today?
Yeah.
You do?
I do. Just because of, like, you know, like, I've seen God, you know, like, just, like, in ways that I wouldn't even think, you know, like, I just know, like, this has to be Jesus, you know what I mean?
You're seeing things that are happening in your life, and you're attributing them to the Christian God.
Yeah.
But this woman would see things in her life and attribute them to a completely different God. How could we go about figuring out who would be more correct in the belief? Is there any way that we can tell that you might be more correct than her? Or vice versa?
I don't know how to answer that.
If you have no way of knowing if you are more correct in the belief than that Muslim woman, how could you possibly be at the 100% mark on the confidence of your belief? Really appreciate it, Miguel.
Now, I realize it's a little bit difficult to remove the video because you're missing some of his expressions. You're certainly the long pauses. It's hard. You can't read his lips whenever there's a lot of ambient noise. So I'm going to include video links, the YouTube links, in the description box so you can go back and watch these after the fact. But it's fascinating to watch him attempt to sort of reconcile and explain when presented with pretty basic questions about his faith.
It was fascinating. And the pathway to success, I think, with street epistemology resides with the person that you're speaking with. If they are honest and open and reflective, if you can create an environment that models that behavior, like Peter was speaking about before, that goes a long way to encouraging people to have these deep conversations with a complete stranger. So yeah, his journey was quite interesting because in about, you know, less than 10 minutes, he went from certainty to, I don't know. And the discussion went from all sorts of different claims. He had started off that he was taught this. He was saved when he was five. That was one thing that kind of jumped out at me during the talk. Like, he was exposed to this at an early age. So me saying, well, obviously the reason you believe this is because you were indoctrinated in it, you know, that probably wouldn't open him up to the point that we were able to achieve by the end of that conversation.
Yeah, I want to stress a few things. Anthony has done this. What you heard in that clip is not atypical. These are very brief conversations, very brief interventions with people you can have. You can learn to do this. Anthony is not a sorcerer. He's not a Jedi. He's not a mystic. Anybody can do this. You follow the template in the book, and you have honest, productive, respectful conversations with people, and you instill doubt. Street epistemology, in a sense, in one sense, a very real sense, is a way to instill doubt in people's confidence. It's a way to help people to become more reflective about their beliefs. And it is not that difficult to help people doubt fundamental beliefs about faith, superstition, religion, gods, etc. And again, you can go to Anthony Magnabosco's channels and see that. I also want to stress, these are real people. They're not actors. And many, many people, in addition to Anthony, have gone out and are now doing this and posting those clips to YouTube. And what I would like to see is a lot more people, led by Anthony's example, to go out and help people become more reflective and less dogmatic in their beliefs.
I gave a presentation last year titled The Beauty of Doubt, and I'd done it for several months in many cities, but I remember I was at the University of Central Oklahoma, and I was on the roster about to give this speech, The Beauty of Doubt. I found out about this story after the fact, but right before I was to go up and speak, we knew there would be a few theists in the audience, and some mother had brought her daughter. And the minute she heard that my speech was about the beauty of doubt, she said, oh, we're not staying here for this. And they got up and left. When you're a believer, it's counterintuitive to want to embrace doubt. Doubt is a sin. Doubting Thomas was not the disciple that we were encouraged to emulate in our own lives. Doubt, you know, those who doubt are like a wave of the sea. And so if you're pitching doubt as a positive, how do you overcome that obstacle?
What a fantastic question. So the fact that, this is my opinion, you can take this for what it's worth, the fact that you had that particular title, you're going to turn off some people. You're also going to have more adversarial relationships. I titled a talk, Jesus, the Easter Bunny, and Other Delusions, Just Say No. And I had a whole sea of Christian apologists, just parenthetically, the people who wanted to ban the talk were the far left on campus. There was not a single Christian, which I was aware, who wanted to ban that talk. But the title of the talk will bring people in, but it will also bring a certain type of person in, and another type of person won't come in. My guess is that if you had titled it Examining Doubt, those people would have stayed.
So if I knew there were going to be theists in the audience, I'm extending an olive branch, or at least hoping to get audience. Maybe a softer approach would have allowed them to not shut down, reinforce, exit the building.
This is also what I think is the essence of street epistemology. Who are the people we're trying to help? And I would argue to you, it's exactly the woman who left with her daughter. She's not a professional apologist. It's like in some of Anthony's videos, he just did a wonderful video with a woman when he asked her about, he just just the other day tweeted it. He can tell you the name. I don't remember her name. What was the name, Anthony?
Her name was Michaela.
Michaela, in which he asked Michaela, who then started to doubt, if she would raise her children in the faith. And I'll let you hear out of her own mouth what her conclusion for that was. But it's, we're not going after professional apologists. We're not having conversations. There's almost no point to, there is a point because they still have hope. But if we want to turn the tide, then we have to help ordinary people like the woman and her daughter who left the audience. Those are the people we have to help because really those are the people who are in great, great need. And by focusing on the average churchgoer, that's when we can see the biggest change.
Let me play the audio of that clip. There's a little bit of setup I'm going to skip. Anything you want to add to this, Anthony? This was a follow-up conversation with someone who was totally sure and totally believed. Is that right?
Yes. I think the clip you're about to play is, this is a clip where it's a young woman who frankly admits that the main reason why she thinks that her God exists is because she was taught it. It was preached to her. And just within 5 minutes of asking her some polite questions, we fostered an environment that encouraged her to examine if it makes sense to be so confident in a belief that can be taught.
Let me play you the clip real fast.
So last we talked, like we had a little 5 minute chat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably been about a week since we last talked. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your bank card and tell me about the pink out game. Whatever happened with that?
Okay, well, my bank card, the bank did something wrong when making my new card, because my first original card, my last name was spelled wrong. And so I realized that when I went to a store and asked my ID, it didn't match. So I'm like, oh, okay. So
that must have been embarrassing.
Yeah, kind of.
You had all your stuff on the counter ready to check out, and they're like, nope.
Yeah, and then I was going grocery shopping with that.
Yeah.
So, I went back to the bank and I was like, my last name is spelled wrong. So then they was like, okay, we're gonna change it. So they changed it, got me a new card, but they didn't activate the card for purchase for online. So then I couldn't buy my pink out tickets on sale because my card wouldn't work.
Yeah.
My family was coming down for the pink out game. So then they tried to give me a temporary number to use. That didn't work. So then I just ended up having to buy the tickets at the door for them.
Was it more expensive at the door?
Yeah, it was $15 extra, which was...
That's not cool.
Not at all. So then finally I went back up here like last week and I was like, okay, we got everything resolved. Try it again and it worked.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay.
Maybe about that.
Well, I'm glad that you finally got that resolved. Because I could tell it was really bumming you out when I ran to you that day.
The tickets were only $5.
Yeah.
And I ended up having to buy them for 20 apiece.
Oh, so that would add up.
Big. Yeah.
Well, what did you think about our talk afterwards?
I thought about how you were saying that, do I really believe in what I've been taught all of my life? You know, do I still 100% believe in that? And it made me just think. Actually, when I went to this church recently, by Sunday, it was called Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 5 minutes away from, 5-10 minutes away from here. And as I was listening to the sermon, like I thought about stuff like, do I truly believe in that, or do I truly live by that? And majority of it, I do.
You do what?
I believe in it and I feel like that I live by that saying or teaching. And so I thought about it, but...
You were in the church thinking about our talk.
Yeah, because he kind of brought it up. He was like, do you ever just sit down and ask yourself, am I really a child of God? Do I really believe in what I'm doing is the right thing to do? And I kind of just piggyback on the question that you were asking me.
Because the discussion that we had largely was based on, could you be taught something that's not true?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said, yeah.
Yeah.
Could this belief that you were taught be not true?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if there's even a chance that your taught belief can be not true, can a person, not just you, but can anybody really honestly be at the 100%?
I don't think so. I don't think they can.
Based on that discussion, and knowing that there's no right or wrong answer, and you're not going to hurt my feelings either way, what would be a more accurate position to be on that belief scale currently today?
I say 50%, because I feel like you've been taught this all your life and it's to be supposed to be true because you've been told that it's true. But as us being young adults, college students, we're just now starting to get out into the world and experience those different types of situations. And we get to see for our own eyes and not from another person's perspective of what actually happens, what actually is the truth. And so I believe that you should always have some type of values or morals that you can just go back on and think about and believe in. But as we grow up and to better understanding of what really happens, then I think you should just be halfway, still have some knowledge of what you've been taught, but still have room for something different than what you've always been taught.
Be open to something else.
Yes, exactly.
Can I ask you like a kind of personal question?
Yeah, sure.
Do you ever plan on like having a family and kids and stuff like that?
Yes.
Okay. That might be a long way off for you, I don't know. Do you think that this discussion that we had would impact the way that you teach your kids, your future children, things that are true?
I actually think that it would, because I would want to teach my children more of personal experiences of what I thought, of what I know as to be real and not fake. Like for an example you use of the Tooth Fairy, maybe, or Santa.
We said, yeah.
Maybe one of those.
Well, you actually came up, I think I maybe gave one, and then like you were like, yeah, Tooth Fairy, Santa,
yeah,
ghosts.
Like those type of scenarios, I think I would, as a parent, tell them that's not true. Mm-hmm. The fairy doesn't come put money under your pillow, the parent does. And I think that might ruin or spoil a childhood memory or whatnot, but I'd rather my child know what's real than what's make-believe.
So the question is posed to her, would any of this potentially change how you raised your children? And she says, yes.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
And if I could just add, that was 2 5-minute encounters with one person. Now, this woman, very friendly person, is going to go back into a community that sees doubt as something bad and not a virtue. They see faith as good and doubt as bad. And what I think we really need, just like with Miguel or with Michaela, if those folks ran into another person that could engage them in a conversation like this a month from now, a month after that occurred, how wonderful would that be to keep that respectful challenging of their beliefs going?
Peter, you use a phrase from time to time that I want to address here. You use the phrase disabusing people of their faith. Can you talk about disabuse? What do you mean?
Faith cannot be relied upon to get one to the truth. How do we know that? Well, we know that because we can look at various faith traditions and various individuals and collectives, groups of individuals who rely upon faith to lead them to the truth. And those faith traditions, in philosophy, we use a term called propositions. It's like a sentence. It's like, instead of talking about beliefs, we talk about how those beliefs are expressed. So the propositions in those faith traditions are mutually exclusive. For example, was Jesus crucified? In the Quran, it says no, and that's a linchpin of many Christians' belief. Now, I will say, again, there are liberation theologians and people, Christians, who deny the historicity of Jesus. Those people are in the minority. So there are conflicting claims that people have. For example, Muslims and Mormons, Joseph Smith being a prophet, Muhammad being the last prophet, and the list of examples goes on and on and on. And those claims that people make, they can't all be true. They can, however, all be incorrect. And more when you talk to people, everyday people, you see the reason that they believe, what they invoke is faith. Faith is for them an epistemology. It's a way they come to knowledge. And the ways that they come to knowledge cannot all be true, given that they have conflicting propositions. They have conflicting beliefs. So when you disabuse someone of their faith, you're disabusing them of a way that they use to come to knowledge, to come to the truth, that they think will bring them to the truth, but will actually not bring them to the truth.
What I think is so important, though, is coming out and being direct and telling somebody that is not going to be effective. You need to let them discover that on their own through Socratic questioning, through the questioning that Peter discusses in his book. That is the method that helps the person view faith and examine it and inspect it to say, wow, this isn't a reliable method to getting to a truth.
As an activist, I find myself sometimes seeing things on the internet when it comes to promoting a rejection of superstition. And I think, wow, that's awesome. That's fantastic. I can't wait to share that. And then conversely, I'll see other things and I just shake my head and I think, how tragic. And one of the things that makes me shake my head is this hugely popular meme that's flying around out there. It's apparently a quote from the television show House, and it says, if you could reason with religious people, there would be no religious people. And I think to myself, every time I see it, I was reasoned out of my faith, right? I was reasoned out of an unreasonable belief system.
Look, for some reason, I can't figure out why. This is some kind of a controversy among atheists. I think either they've thrown in the towel and they have a sense of despair, or they've lost all their hope. If you learn nothing else from Anthony's videos, you can see that we can have hope. We can help people learn to read. Look, you are the perfect example of that. John W. Loftus, I just wrote the foreword to his book, How to Be a Christian Apologist. He was a disciple of William Lane Craig. I mean, he was on that path. People are constantly, daily, reasoned out of their faith. They're shown that they can value reason and rationality to live better lives and help them flourish. And I think we have to put an end to this. Frankly, to be blunt, the unevidenced belief in the atheist community or among atheists that people cannot be reasoned out of their faith. It's simply not true. I mean, you just heard a tape from Michaela where not only has Anthony done that in 5 minutes, 2 5-minute interventions, but now when she has children, if she has children, her children will be the beneficiaries of not being held hostage to religious delusions. So I think it's time for us to rethink this meme, this idea, this unevidenced belief that many atheists have that you cannot reason people out of their faith. Look, you can reason people in and out of anything that you want. I was in the prisons. I reasoned people out of violent crime. You can, and I continue to do that. I'm going to apply for this project, and I'll go back into the prisons to work with violent criminals in only 5-minute conversations. You can do this in very short periods of time. And I think we need to start thinking about that differently and being more honest about what we ourselves take pride in, which is basing our beliefs on evidence. There is simply no evidence whatsoever that you cannot reason people out of their beliefs, that people are reasoned out of their beliefs constantly.
I worry sometimes that there's a shade of activism among atheists, that it's just a superiority thing, right? They're brain damaged. They're stupid. They're idiots. I mean, we've all run it. You can be stupid about anything. But the idea of making a blanket statement that if they are religious, they are mentally defective and we should write them off. There are hugely intelligent people who have embraced unreasonable things. And there's a very complex sort of host of reasons why that happens. Yes?
Even deeper than that, what a sense of despair. What a kind of disparaging way to look at your fellow human beings. So I think it is a combination of smugness. I also think it's a frustration. And I'm not saying that frustration is unjustified. I am saying that if you really want to help people, and some atheists don't want to help people, they just want to be smug or they just want to live their own lives. But even if you just want to live your own lives, many people who hold faith-based beliefs are preventing you from living your own life. So I think we need to start being more honest and thinking about this strategically, thinking about this not in a sense of despair, not in a sense of calling people names, but of understanding that people hold these beliefs for a complex set of reasons, psychosocial valuation, thinking they're a better person, kind of moral self-esteem. And again, through very brief interventions and conversations, we can help people to reflect on the reasons why they have these beliefs and, frankly, why these beliefs are so hurtful and harmful to so many people.
I want to talk about mockery in just a second. Anthony Magnabosco, you have anything to add to that?
You know, I do think there's a lot of condescension on the atheist side and not giving the theist credit. They're fellow human beings. You know, they're the people that you love. They're your friends.
I mean, there are some people that are in my cross. William Lane Craig he's an easy target. You know, there are some people who are on the forefront, the Ray Comforts and whatnot, who, you know, it's hard for me to look at them with a lot of sympathy. Anthony.
Sure, but William Lane Craig doesn't live down the street for me.
It's true.
I'd rather have a conversation with a person in my community that my kids might interact with, you know, in 5 years than somebody who's an apologist that I'm never going to meet. So I do think it's somewhat condescending to just shut people down and not give them the benefit of the doubt that maybe they haven't even considered the reasons why they hold the belief. And also, you know, being aggressive can shut people down. You need to oftentimes go slow, figure out what speed they need to go at and try to meet them where they're at and don't rush them. Some people need time to think this through.
Is that knowing the difference between being assertive and aggressive? And we're not talking about weakness. You're not a milquetoast going in and just folding like a cheap suit. You're going in with confidence, but also with compassion, right?
There's a fine line. There is such a fine line to keep people focused and on track and insulting them. And sometimes you find that balance and sometimes you fail miserably at it.
We mentioned William Lane Craig. It's funny, in your video, Peter Boghossian, you said William Lane Craig is irrelevant.
That's right.
Tell me why.
He's totally irrelevant because how many people do you think William Lane Craig has led to the faith? Not many. I mean, that's an empirical question for which I don't have any data. But William Lane Craig has helped convince people who already believe. And if anything, the damage that he's done to reason and rationality and taking away a legitimate sense of hope instead of a delusional sense of hope is that those arguments are propagated. He's become a white knight. What we need to do is shift the focus from professional apologists into exactly what Anthony said, into people in our communities, into people we love, into people we know, and to people. Just the other day, I had a conversation with someone on the subway, just as really on the Orange Line, just as an off comment. He said something to me that truly, in all the years I've been doing this, nobody had ever said to me before. He said, "Would you rather be in heaven for a trillion years or go to hell and have a spoon?"
I'm totally lost because
I was totally lost too. You know, the Greeks call it aporia. Like, I was mystified by that. But this guy, you have to meet him where is that? Even that kind of a question that somebody would ask tells you where they are in their thinking, right? And so this guy, I didn't ask him if he's heard of any professional apologists, D'Souza, William Bentley Hart, any of these people, but more than likely not. So we have focused our energies on the wrong thing. And while we've been doing that, churches, mosques, synagogues, temples that get church exempt status are able to spread their faulty, unreliable epistemologies. And real people have gotten hurt. And so we need to make a shift from the top to the quote unquote the bottom. Some people have said it's low hanging fruit. It's not a question of low hanging fruit makes it again like a chess game. This is a win-win situation. Not only is that how we need to frame it, but it is actually a win-win situation. Either we learn something or they learn something. And if no one learns something, at least we're civil enough so that now we know we can have a conversation so that this place doesn't become like Iraq.
Anthony Magnabosco, I've got a clip here, an exchange between you and someone named Jamil. You want to set this up before I play it for our audience?
Yeah. So Jamil agrees to talk with me for 5 minutes. It runs a little bit longer, but he's quite interesting because his mother is Christian and his father believes in Islam, is a Muslim. And interestingly, that the manner with which he was raised is causing somewhat of a schism because he's not sure which is true, but he's 100% sure a God exists. And the main reason why he thinks that that's true is because he thinks prayer works.
Here's the clip between Jamil and Anthony Magnabosco.
Hey, man. Dude, do you have like 5 minutes for a quick chat?
Yeah.
You do? Okay. Can I live stream you and record you?
Yeah.
Are you okay?
Fine.
Thank you. Thanks for stopping, dude.
Yeah,
I'm Anthony.
Jamil.
Jamil. Yeah. Can I get the spelling of that?
Yeah, J-A-M-I-L.
Jamil.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Okay. What I'm doing, Jamil, is just chatting with anybody randomly to see if they hold any God beliefs and why.
Okay.
Are there any particular... Is there a particular God that you believe in? And are you comfortable spending like 5 minutes just to examine why you hold the belief?
Yeah, well, my parents are actually conflicting religions. My dad practices Islam and my mom practices Catholicism. So when I was younger, my mom wanted me to go to a Catholic school, you know, for elementary school, for primary school. And my dad actually agreed. But some things happened, like with the initial schooling. So I ended up not going. That's our friend. And ended up not going. But my mom, you know, would try to teach me Christian beliefs. You know, we did Christmas, you know, we did all that stuff.
Yeah.
We did Easter. We celebrated Easter. But at the same time, my dad was, you know, he wanted me to pray with him, you know, the 3 times a day, the normal.
Did you ever do the fasting?
Yeah, he wanted me. I did fasting with him when I was younger.
Really?
And all that. But, you know, as I got older, you know, because they kept both pushing different, you know, conflicting ideas and religions in me, made it really hard for me to choose. So I still, you know, I do believe in God. It's just when it comes to a certain religion or, you know, like, I guess, focus, I'm still, you know, confused about that myself. Because my dad was, you know, having me read the Quran at the same time my mom was having me read the Bible. And they both knew that they were doing it at the same time. So, it, you know, I have a brother, he's going through the same thing, so.
Do you think that they had any idea that after exposing you to both religions that you would identify as neither one?
I think that they were both hoping that me and my brother would either identify as either or. My dad, you know, saying, oh, I'm the man, and, you know, Islam, you have to follow the husband.
Are you the oldest?
Yeah, I'm the oldest, so. I think they both kind of wanted us to identify as either or, but...
Do they know that you don't follow either or?
We haven't really talked about it, but I think that they know that me and my brother, we don't really follow either or because, you know, my dad still asks us, you know, do we read the Quran regularly? And, you know, sometimes we tell him yes, sometimes we tell him no. He's like, he knows we don't pray anymore now that we're older. I mean, we go to church sometimes with our mom, not very frequently because... my dad, you know, he doesn't really like it when we go, so.
Okay.
They know we don't really follow one.
Yeah.
But they're all, I know both of them are hoping that we pick, you know.
Do you think if you grew up in a family where both parents were Catholic, would you be Catholic?
I think I would be, yes.
If both parents were Muslims, would you be following Islam?
Yeah, because how it worked when I was growing up, you know, they knew that my dad would know I was learning Catholicism, so he would show me the contradicting ideas and then the similar ideas. So me and my brother grew up understanding the differences and the similarities between both religions. And because of that, I know, you know, it kind of makes more sense to me having to learn two at the same time rather than, you know, one person learning Catholicism and then hating, you know, Muslims and not knowing anything about the religion at all, you know. So I think I do support both, you know what I mean? I see the views in both of them, and I do agree with both of them, so.
You agree with both of them?
Yeah.
Do you think that both are correct?
That's where I'm having the struggle picking, or it's hard to tell, because they have, you know, very similar ideas at the same time, but they have very, you know, contradicting ideas, and, but in both sense, they make sense to, you know, different people. So if I, you know, grew up in a house for Catholicism, I would have practiced without a doubt. And then if Islam, probably the same thing, but doing both, it's very hard, which is why me and my brother, haven't really picked one yet.
Sure. As of now. Yet you're here today, even though you've had that, and you've outlined that beautifully, by the way.
Thank you.
Yet you're holding on to a God belief still. Does this God have a name, or is it more of a nebulous God, or like,
what are we? It's more just like, I guess, a nebulous God.
Okay. How sure are you that that God exists? If 0% is, I'm not confident at all, it's all doubt. 100% is all confidence and no doubt, and you could be anywhere on the scale.
I'm 100% that he's there, yeah.
How do you know?
It's really hard to tell. My mom has a lot of stories, you know, where she thinks she's, you know, had God influence in her life, you know, little stories. You know, she'll be crossing like an alleyway and there's like two like really, really scary pit bulls that are notorious for attacking people. And she said that there was a time when it was like in the middle of the night, and she was walking home through this alley, and like they're notorious for jumping over the fence. She grew up in the Philippines, so they're notorious for jumping over the fence and attacking people. And it was in the middle of the night, and they were barking, and she said that a dog showed up, walked her through the alley, and the dogs didn't bark at her that night. And then when she like looked down again, it was gone. And I've had, you know, a few experiences where there was this girl that I met, you know, on a computer game, hadn't talked to in about like 4 years, you know, in a computer game, you know, online, you don't talk to someone for 4 years, you're never gonna find them. It so happened that I actually ran into her on a separate forum on something else, because that, it was weird, because the day before, actually, I prayed to God, I was like, I really missed her, you know, I got along with her, I really, really missed her, and I was like, somehow, some way, you know, I'd like to see, talk to her again, and I ran into her, okay. After like 4 years of not seeing her, so.
I see.
I do believe in God, I believe he's there.
Do you believe in the God because you think prayer works, because when you prayed for them, you found this long-lost friend, and then when your mother said she reached out to her God, suddenly this dog protected her.
Yeah, it's that, and then, you know, I still believe, you know, all this stuff had to come in from somewhere, you know. It's not like it just started. Someone had to do something. So
can we focus on the prayer just maybe a little bit more?
The prayer? Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying, and if I'm off, please correct me. But are you saying that one of the reasons why you're 100% sure that your God exists is because you feel that prayer is working when you pray for something?
Yes. But I've noticed that it works really weird. Because I've prayed for stuff before and it doesn't happen. But when, I guess, I've noticed when I have a lot more feeling, because like when I prayed for the girl the one time, I did cry a little, you know. I mean, not like cry, I didn't sob, but I did tear up, you know, because I missed her.
Sure.
And it happened, but then, you know, I'll pray for like something else, you know, like I don't know, I'm just gonna make stuff like, you know, I'll do well on a test, and I end up not doing well on the test. But I mean, that was my fault. I could have studied more.
Okay.
But you know, with the girl, like I couldn't. There was nothing I could do possibly to, you know, and I really, really want to see it. So
why is prayer weird though?
Because people, you know, they pray for something. You know, I always hear people talking about they pray for something and then it doesn't happen. And they're like, oh, you know, he's not listening and all this. But he is, you know, I think that he is listening. It's just he picks and chooses the right prayers to, you know, actually help on. And other times, like, he's helping you, you just don't realize it. You know, like, if someone asks for money, he's not going to just, you know, put $100 on the floor. He'll, you know, someone will come up to him and be like, I have a job opportunity for you.
Sometimes
you
know? Prayer works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, well... Yeah, it really depends on, like, you know, what you're praying for. Really.
Okay. You could pray for something and it wouldn't happen, but you wouldn't look at it as the God not existing.
Yeah.
You would just say, well, what would your response be?
It was more of like a, I guess, I don't want to say like a selfish prayer, but it was a prayer where if I didn't pray, or if I didn't, you know, pray for it, there was something I could have done personally in my power to have, you know, fixed the outcome myself.
Why would you pray at all then?
That comfort, it helped me, you know, knowing that I was able to talk to someone, ask someone for help, even if, you know, I didn't get the help, I still...
If a belief gives you comfort or an action gives you comfort, does it always mean that what you're asking for or who you're asking exists or it's true or it's real?
I guess to me, personally, I guess it would. If it did give me comfort, if I did think it was working, then yeah, it would be, you know, there would be faith. I would believe in it. But I could see how to other people, you know, if it wasn't doing anything, if it was just providing comfort, then it wouldn't be. But
are you saying, there are times where you'll pray for something, you don't get it.
Yeah.
But you still pray because you feel like it gives you a sense of comfort.
Yeah.
Is there any way that we can test prayer to determine that it really works in the way that you have outlined?
I don't know, honestly. It's one of those things you know, it's a really hard question. I don't think you can test prayer. There might be someone with, you know, a much more diverse mind than I who could come up with a test for prayer.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, but with the knowledge I have, I honestly don't think that
that's the thing you could test for, you know?
You know what, Jamil? If prayer can't be tested, and prayer is one of the main reasons why you're at the 100%, but it can't be tested, is 100% the right spot to be on the confidence that the belief is true?
I guess not. It probably wouldn't be. Probably not 100%, but I mean, there are other, you know, little factors that I don't really know about, but I just, you know, to myself, I feel like, I don't know if it was, you know, all the
teachings. If there are other factors that you don't know, wouldn't that lend you more towards moving down on the scale than being...
Well, I mean, like, more factors as in, like, you know, the fact that, you know, my parents, like, taught me, you know, maybe all the things that I learned, I just have this, like, this, you know, unconscious feeling that I do 100%, you know, believe, even though I can't, you know, put a you know, pin on the fact, like, exactly what it is that makes me believe 100%.
If prayer can't be tested adequately, at least not in a way that we can identify, and you recognize that maybe 100% isn't the right spot to be, what would be a more honest position to be at on the belief scale?
More honest? Probably sit myself at maybe 60%.
Thank you very much for your time.
So do you just dive into the deep end? I mean, do you jump in and say, let's talk about your religious belief in these types of exchanges? And either one of you can answer. But I know Peter Boghossian's talked about developing rapport before you handle some of the heavier questions, right? If they don't feel any connection to you, you're really going to take them off guard. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that rapport building phase is so critical. It's very tempting for me to just want to get right to it. I've got a timer going. I might have a camera going. There might even be an audience watching. So there's a little bit of pressure, and sometimes I skip that rapport building phase. But it's a mistake to do so because, number one, it puts a person at ease. And number two, it gives you a chance to learn a little bit more about them so that later on in the conversation, for example, if they mention that they're afraid of flying, well, that could be a very useful thing to mention later on in the discussion when they start talking about faith.
How do we guard against this becoming sort of disingenuous? I mean, I don't want it to be just a setup, right? You're lulling them into a false sense of security and then you go for the kill is kind of the fear that I would have. What's the difference?
The key thing there is a willingness to change. Everyone that I speak with, I try to remind myself that Jamil may know that prayer works. Miguel might be following the right God. The pagan that I talk to, the goddess that she thinks is protecting her, she may be correct. So I always try to approach every conversation as a way for me to learn something. And sometimes it's hard to remind myself of that if you hear the same argument over and over again, the same justification for a belief. But I really am open to changing my mind. And I think that's quite different than what you might see with an evangelist or a preacher or somebody that's proselytizing, somebody that's telling a person what to think. That's not at all what this is.
Peter Boghossian, do you start slow or do you start with a certain angle?
So I think it's really important that you stick to the template in the book when you first start this. If you don't, people become baffled and they don't understand why this doesn't work. Once you've done this and you have a feel for it, then you can start experimenting and shifting and changing. And even to this day, I still experiment and change up what I do. But almost always, I build some kind of rapport process. But it's different. Different people are situated differently. They have different reasons for why they believe. I follow the template in the book still. The other day, about a week ago, a buddy of mine and I were coming back for lunch and walking home. And we ran into two more Mormon missionaries, and I tried a different tactic, a slightly more aggressive tactic, to see how that would work. So I'm constantly mixing it up. But again, Derrida about philosophy, my least favorite philosopher says, in order to deconstruct a tradition, you have to know it. In order to kind of branch off and do your own thing, you really have to know the basic template in the book.
I'm sure it's applicable to many industries, but in video production, they say you have to know the rule before you can break it, right?
That's right. Different people have different strengths. Some people are very funny. I try not to use humor too much because that can backfire. But different people have different strengths, and you need to bring those strengths to bear. And I don't mean as a club, but I mean as a way to helping people examine their beliefs.
Let's talk about mockery, about ridicule, the ridicule of the ridiculous. Let's talk about the micro versus the macro. Can you start by defining macro and micro for us?
I'm glad you brought that up. So micro one-on-one small scale interventions, macro are large interventions like propaganda campaigns. I talked about that at my Imagine No Religion 5 talk, Islamism and Doubt.
Give me some example. I mean, I get the one-on-one. What would be a macro? Would it be
like an advertising campaign, a propaganda campaign, something that what Dawkins does is macro level. Ricky Gervais is macro level.
Like a billboard that tackles religion in a sarcastic way kind of thing.
Yeah, these aren't one-on-one interactions, okay. Penn Jillette. My very good friend, Jamie Ian Swiss, we have a substantive disagreement about this. I have nothing but respect and love for Jamie. He has a much harder approach than I do. And he has a much more, I'm very blunt. And by the way, I saw Dave Silverman's talk. He's called a firebrand atheist. I didn't really see anything that I wouldn't really consider that approach a firebrand atheist. The only difference between what Dave does, as far as I can tell, I haven't read his new book yet, have ordered it. The only thing that Dave does that I don't do is draw pictures of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, because I personally don't think that's productive, but that would be an example of something that could have potentially serious consequences in a number of different ways.
So if in the one-on-one, you don't want someone to feel insulted or attacked, so you're not using ridicule or mockery in the micro intervention, but in the macro, mockery can be an effective tool.
Dawkins and I have talked about this. We talked about this in our May 5th talk. He's come out publicly about this, and I think he's right. We need a mix of strategies. I'm offering one strategy based upon the research literature of what we know for a fact works when people change their beliefs. I mean, this is not plucked out of the sky. This is based upon the literature, and all those references are in my book. So we know that this is effective in helping people break through systems of thought in which they feel trapped or dogmatic ideas. So some people, Emery has a film, A Year Without God, from Ryan Bell. And I interviewed Ryan for that, and we had a great interview in that. And Jamie Ian Swiss interviewed him for that, and he had a very different approach than I had going into that. And I'm not going to tell Jamie that he's incorrect. I am going to tell him that I know what I do works. And I think that the tent is big enough for us to have different approaches to help people see reality and to shed these delusions that they're facing. On a macro level, if you're reaching millions of people like Penn Jillette, et cetera, those techniques or mocking certain ideas can help shake people up a little bit and possibly get them to reflect on things. Also, it could backfire and get people to become more entrenched in their beliefs. And I would certainly never tell anybody that there's a specific strategy that they should have. But what I will say is the strategy that I've written about is based in the literature, and we know it works.
Anthony?
I think mockery certainly has its place, and we see it time and time again, whether it's Bill Maher making a joke or Richard Dawkins in a debate. But mockery is a tool in the arsenal. Street epistemology is another one of those tools. There's a spectrum of tools available for us to converse with believers, and I think it's largely dependent on the venue that you're in and the person that you're speaking with. If I were to mock Miguel or to mock Jamil or to mock Michaela, that probably wouldn't get me very far.
If the end zone is for you to walk away and feel superior, hey, great, mockery just accomplished your ends.
True.
If your goal is to change minds and perhaps help to, quote, disabuse someone of their faith, then mockery is the worst thing you can do.
If your goal is to feel superior, you really should think about having another goal.
Well, there are some people who disagree with these tactics. There are some people who think this is just a bunch of crap. Come on, this is too touchy-feely.
Just think about the type of person who would set themselves up that goal. I mean, if that's your goal, why don't you go into a kindergarten and just berate people? No, I mean, but I'm really serious. I mean, that's anyone who would have that goal probably has deeper moral problems. They really need, those are the people who we need to be conducting street epistemology on them. We need to help them become more compassionate. These are people who are, these are not bad people. It was Hitchens who said that religion causes good people to do bad things. These are really good people. These are your neighbors. These are your friends. These are people you love. And they're trapped in a dangerous belief system. Why on earth would you want to ridicule them for that? Why? If your goal, now somehow maybe you think in some way, and maybe in a weird way you could be right. If you ridicule them, then you'll help them. I don't see evidence for that, but I'm not saying it's impossible. But if your goal is to feel superior to somebody, you really need to think about that. You need to take a good look in the mirror and ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Someone's compassion has been short-circuited. There is a problem with someone who thinks like that.
Before we wrap up our conversation, and I know I spent the entire broadcast with two guests, I felt like the content they brought was rich enough that it warranted the entire show. I'm privileged and honored that they would spend the time on the radio. And Peter, your book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, changed how I approached my friends who are believers, because especially coming right out of the faith, I was pissed off that I'd been lied to. I'd had all of these walls built around me. I mean, why was I in my mid to late 30s before I began to read and see and learn the works of legitimate scientists and begin to discover the world and the cosmos as it really is? And I was mad that nobody was listening. I had a lot of those kinds of issues, right?
And what was the response from your friends?
They just shut down. I mean, they when I came after them, it was, they immediately reinforced the wall.
Right.
They weren't listening, and it became this condescending pat on the head. You know, we'll pray for you. One day you'll discover the love of Jesus. You're just going through a time. It's a midlife crisis, whatnot. We had no discourse. I essentially just came in and like, this is the stupidest thing ever. Right. You know, and I had no traction with it whatsoever. And after I read the book, and this is why I really want people to at least consider this as a possibility, when I began to soften and begin to lead with more questions and certainly lead with compassion, I found that at the very least, they didn't shut down, say they're going to pray for me and bolt from the door. We actually had long form conversations. It opened up doors and possibilities that were not there before.
Right. And so you saw the change. That goes back to something else about which we have spoken, is that people can be reasoned out of beliefs that they didn't reason themselves into. And so what I would like to see, in addition to more civility and more conversations with like the ones that we have with believers, I would like to see people follow Anthony's example. And I would like to see as many people as we can engaging people of faith, going out into the communities and helping people of faith, helping people to disabuse them of ways that they think are helping them build better lives and helping them build more communities that flourish. But if they're right, acknowledging that and then learning that, and then come tell me how they're right, what you've learned. If we get enough people to do this, we can literally turn the tide on this. The book is there. Anthony's videos are there. They're 5 minutes. It's not hard to learn. If enough people do this, we can make a critical mass, particularly if they're posted on YouTube. We can help people develop reliable epistemologies or reliable ways of knowing faster than churches can indoctrinate people.
We have to keep the ball moving. We have to keep this ball rolling. And being able to come on a show like this to educate people, and at the very least, let non-believers know that there is a different way, is so crucially important.
And Dr. Boghossian, you have, is it a smartphone app? What are you working on?
I have a cross-platform app that Anthony has been a key, crucial part of that we've developed with many people over the course of a year and a half. It's an app that takes users, guides them through a step-by-step process for when somebody says something, how to engage them in a civil way, but how to instill doubt in any comment anybody says, and it's for virtually any religion. And hopefully we'll have the app out by December. That's the goal. And it's for your phones.
How would someone search that? Does it have a name yet, or are you still in development?
The name is Atheos. The webpage is atheos-app, atheos-app.com. And it's based on Plato's caves. And you lead the prisoners out of the cave of faith and into the light of reason. And it has literally tens of thousands of fields of virtually every question you can think of, and correct and incorrect responses, and a complicated, elaborate reward system for users based upon their responses.
People sometimes ask me why I do what I do, and have this pat sort of answer. I say, I want to promote good information. I want to debunk bad information, and I want to help people. It's my hope that this broadcast will be a part of that. And for being a guest on the show, both of you, thank you so much for your time and for your contributions. Really good stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you so much for listening to the broadcast tonight. Again, a huge thanks to our show sponsor, Harry's Razors, a better shave experience delivered right to your door, and $5 off your first purchase with the coupon code THINKINGATHEIST at harrys.com, HARRYS.com. And I'll see you next week.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.